WNYC. And why is there so much anger in American politics today? My next guest takes a deep dive into history and blames Voltaire. Well, not quite. But author and columnist Pankaj Mishra has a new book that suggests the ideas of the Enlightenment that most of you listening probably hold dear could never fulfill the aspirations of enough people to succeed as the organizing principles of society. So this fracturing into various kinds of resentful nationalisms was almost inevitable. Even worse, he suggests, Western Enlightenment was never even designed for the masses, but for the satisfaction of the elites who are now getting it from all sides. The book is called Age of Anger, A History of the Present. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
So you argue that the ideas of the Enlightenment in recent decades are not sufficient. Where do you want to go back? I mean, all right, forgive me. Let me start here. You wrote that we have stopped talking about revolution and we've dismantled social democracy, and now we try to fulfill all these goals through the market. We could spend a whole segment talking just about that.
Well, thank you, first of all, for your very accurate summary of the book, the best I've come across so far. I mean, I think what I'm trying to argue is that Enlightenment ideals, first of all, were indeed formulated by an elite, and mostly for their benefit. These ideas very explicitly excluded certain communities, for instance, Native Americans, blacks, slaves, all kinds of people were simply not considered human by the people in the late 18th century who were talking about freedom from older forms of authority, from religion, from tradition. Well, a lot of people were simply not seen as deserving of that kind of freedom.
And this is the part of the story that's so well known, I think, about the founding of the United States on these high ideals that seem to go beyond even the high ideals that some in Western Europe had held previously. But yes, blacks were excluded, Native Americans were excluded, et cetera. But a lot of the rest of American history is the story of, as we were just hearing from Bob Herbert, imperfect as it is, the fight for inclusion. And so eventually slavery was abolished, and we got the 14th Amendment, and women got the right to vote, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which could argue the opposite of your premise, that Enlightenment values are the best ones to try to base Western society on, or all societies on. What we have to do is the hard work of making sure it does really include everybody.
Well, I don't disagree with that at all. I mean, I argue in this book and other places that there is no going back. And when you go back, you end up with the kind of ethnic, racial nationalism that we see erupting around the world today, a kind of fantasy, a dangerous fantasy of wholeness, of an unviolated past. I think we can only go forward. We can only struggle harder to realize these ideals of the modern world and to make them, you know, rewarding for more and more people, not just for the elite. So the struggle has to go on. But we also have to acknowledge that these ideals of inclusion have actually excluded, in practice, large numbers of people, and certainly the kind of politics and economy we've been following in recent decades is hostile to those ideals. And, you know, this is where an obsession with hyper-competitiveness of extending the principles of the marketplace to every domain of human existence, to every aspect of our human society, has proven to be disastrous because it has taken us further away from those ideals of equality and liberty.
About capitalism, you write that the hope was that global capitalism could spread prosperity far and wide, but instead we've seen massive spikes in inequality as a result.
Well, you know, I mean, this whole project of economic expansion, especially after 1945, which you could argue the world has progressively embraced, and, you know, it has brought great disruption to the lives of hundreds of millions of people. But all that change, all that revolutionary change was made tolerable by the possibility that we were all going to be part of this, you know.
Yes.
And we were all going to be beneficiaries of this particular an often very traumatic process. But when those collective hopes are betrayed, when they are subverted by a small minority of people who monopolize not just wealth, but also cultural, intellectual capital, inevitably, a lot of people are going to be very angry, and that is what we see today.
Let's take a phone call. Ian in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I agree that the Enlightenment was begun as a project by the elite, especially if you look at France in the 18th century. But I think that there were other members of what we consider the Enlightenment proponent generation, both in England and in what eventually became the U.S., the American colonies, who were very much proponents of not only broadening what they saw as the purported effects of rationality, but also they thought that people, being empiricists as they were in the Lockean tradition, that people themselves could be tutored to be rational as well. And not everybody was a Hobbesian in the initial Hobbesian sense of mandatory and control government that had extensive power. And so people like Jefferson were very much proponents of broadening the effects of the Enlightenment and bringing rationality to a broad swath of society.
Well, you know, I think there are obviously many, many strands to the Enlightenment. There were all kinds of thinkers. It cannot be seen as a monolith. But I think we have to be alert to the particular histories that flowed from those ideals, and also be sensitive to the really more influential proponents of those ideals. What were they actually saying at that time, and how were their ideals realized through the course of history?
You want to give me an example?
Well, I think, you know, the reason why we are still debating the ideas of Rousseau, for instance, or Voltaire, is because their debate illuminates a whole set of problems that we still haven't, got rid of. Here is Voltaire, for instance, speaking up on behalf of the metropolitan elite, believing in international commerce, believing in rational self-interest, in self-love. And here is Rousseau saying, well, you know, the self-love, which you see as the engine of commercial society, is spiritually and psychologically very debilitating. So, you know, here are some very massive differences being articulated very early on, and Rousseau arguing against change, especially change from above, and saying this is a radically disruptive process, and you know, it's going to really deform inner lives in a very serious way, which is going to have political consequences. And of course, we've seen that, in the course of modern history.
And so when we hear Steve Bannon, for example, at CPAC the other week, say we should think of ourselves as a nation with an economy, not just a nation that's participating in a global economy, and also a nation with a culture, it may come from, a very tainted messenger. But you're saying he's reflecting something that that is very widespread in the population.
Very much so. And, you know, let's not also forget, however much we may dislike people like Steve Bannon, that they come at the end or they belong to a long tradition of supremacists, of nationalists, of protectionists, who have made precisely that kind of argument, that enough of this cosmopolitanism, of this internationalism. We have to redefine our borders. We have to redefine our boundaries, and basically be alert to the experience of a particular community and be responsive to it, not just embrace a kind of abstract and opaque internationalism.
But what's the bulwark against nativism and xenophobia, if not a sort of globalist enlightenment take on the world?
Well, I don't think this can be reduced to a binary opposition. There are many ways of countering this kind of xenophobic nationalism. I think a simple emphasis on the dignity of the individual should be enough to counter aggressive, dangerous ideas of the sort Mr. Bannon is advocating right now.
Pankaj Mishra with us, author of Age of Anger, A History of the Present. And Jim in the South Bronx, you're on WNYC. Jim, you there?
Ah, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling to completely disagree with your guest. You intimated yourself beginning this segment that all the liberation movements of the last 200 years used the paradigm of enlightenment. Civil rights, anti-colonialism, let's not forget that, women's rights, gay rights, all of them. Secondly, he's also wrong about the cultural aspect, because modern nationalism comes from the French Revolution, which is itself an outgrowth of enlightenment. He's dead wrong, and this stuff must be opposed root and branch.
Well,
that's my comment.
I'm afraid you're disagreeing with something that I've not actually said. And in fact, you know, I don't disagree with you at all. I agree with you. So I'm not quite sure what you're objecting to here.
Shall I continue?
Yeah.
When, for instance, Dr. King articulated the civil rights movement in the 60s, it wasn't in terms of, you know, some sort of black identity politics or reparations, which we just heard about. It was in terms of, you know, universal human rights. Right? And likewise, when women began to articulate their opposition to subordination, it was in terms of the universal rights of human beings, of which women are. And nationalism, again, comes out of the French Revolution, and the idea that cultural groups can exist side by side within a sort of like unified European order, even before the European Union. That's what I now, if you agree with that, then I guess we don't have any disagreement.
The argument being that Western Enlightenment values can be the basis of advanced civilizations.
Exactly.
Well, we're not disagreeing. We mentioned that earlier on. I'm not disagreeing with that at all. What I'm saying is that those ideals have to be realized for the large numbers of people out there for whom these ideals have proved to be a cruel illusion. So I don't disagree with it at all. I mean, you know, we can also argue about Martin Luther King, just exactly what kind of ideals he was propagating. I think it's important to remember that he was also a very devout Christian. And a lot of his rhetoric, a lot of his sort of very explicitly stated goals, they cannot be separated from his Christian beliefs.
Jim, thank you for your call. When we come back from a break, I want to play a clip of President Obama from the last weeks of his presidency arguing that this is the best time in the history of the world to be alive, and get your take. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Pankaj Mishra, author of Age of Anger, A History of the Present. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, excuse me, with the columnist and author Pankaj Mishra, whose new book is Age of Anger, A History of the Present. He'll be doing an appearance tomorrow, by the way, tomorrow night at the Brooklyn Public Library with Hari Kunzru. That's at 7:30 tomorrow night, Brooklyn Public Library. I want to play a clip of President Obama last fall making a case that these are literally the best of times.
Everybody's shouting and everybody hates each other, and you get kind of depressed. You think, goodness, what's happening? But the truth is that when you look at all the measures of well-being in the world, if you had a choice of when to be born, and you didn't know ahead of time who you were going to be, what nationality, whether you were male or female, what religion, but you said, when in human history would be the best time to be born? The time would be now. The world has never been healthier. It's never been wealthier. It's never been better educated. It's never been less violent, more tolerant than it is today. Now, we don't always see that because there are terrible things that are happening around the world. And there are real tragedies and injustice that are happening. And it's your job to fix it. But you should never be discouraged because you have more opportunity today to make a difference in the world than any generation before. And my hope is that you will seize that opportunity and you'll know that you will have a strong friend and partner in the United States of America when you do.
President Obama, I believe that was at a commencement address last year. So how much do you agree with his take on the state of the world in the context of all of human history? And to the extent that you do agree, why is everybody so angry?
You know, I think these kinds of statements, which are boosterish in nature, are perhaps a legitimate response to dark visions of American carnage that Mr. Trump has been peddling for some months now. But, you know, when you examine them, when you kind of break them down, I don't think they acknowledge the reality of suffering and traumatic change for large numbers of people alive in the world today. This is all very well, you know, for members of the elite to argue that the world has never been wealthier or less violent and more tolerant. But if you are an inhabitant of the Middle East or indeed of the rural American South, a lot of this rhetoric would sound pretty hollow to you. So I think, you know, thinking that the times we live in is the best ever, this is a kind of conceit of modern men right from the beginning of the modern world, which just does not take into account how human beings thought about themselves, say, Renaissance Florence, not to mention any number of pre-modern tribal communities. You know, thinking that we are on top, that we are on the summit of human history, this is an unsupportable conceit, I think, I would argue. And, you know, looking at measures in quantitative terms, in a way you could argue this focus on statistics, this focus on graphs and charts of, you know, looking at human life in this manner has brought us to this sorry pass, you know, that we've actually not taken into account so many other human needs for solidarity, for community, a sense of belonging, self-respect, identity. And this has been a great failing of the technocratic elites to which, I'm sorry to say, President Obama also belongs and belonged.
Dignity of the individual not being sufficient, as many elites would hope, versus dignity from community?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not just through the acquisition of wealth that you acquire dignity. It's also by virtue of belonging to a community, of having a job that, you know, gives you self-respect. These things are also important. And for a lot of people, these things have gone tragically, desperately missing.
Aaron in Teaneck, you're on WNYC. Hi, Aaron.
Yeah, thank you. This is a wonderful topic and sounds like a great book. My question is, there's a conflict between East and West in the sense of identity and spirit, belonging, you know, compassion. I mean, really all those kind of critical identities or components of one's identity. What's been the impact of those differences in the development of enlightenment, which has been very Western-driven, versus the concepts of enlightenment, which are very Eastern-driven, and how has that impacted, you know, really where we are today? And I'd look forward to the author's view on that.
Thank you for your question. You know, I actually don't believe that there is any such conflict between East and West. You know, we keep on positing this clash of civilizations and base so much of our policy around these supposed divisions. I think we all inhabit the modern world. You know, the fact that a figure like Trump emerging in the United States after the emergence of various demagogues in different parts of the world is only one of the many signs that, you know, we basically inhabit the same reality. The world is constituted by sameness, similarity, not by religious, cultural, theological difference. And this is a really important point that we have to acknowledge, because unless we do that, unless we recognize that suffering, for instance, is indivisible, that the dislocations of our modern global economy can cause suffering in different parts of the world, that wars, invasions, the suffering caused by that can be felt universally, and, you know, East and West have on those divisions between East and West have almost nothing to do with that. So I think one has to sort of move away from this way of looking at the world as essentially, you know, divided up into these different regions and ideologies.
We condemn individualism, but we condemn identity politics and nationalisms. Where's the sweet spot?
You know, I think, you know, too much is made of identity politics, for instance. You know, it's a way of asking for justice. It's a way of struggling for certain rights that have been denied to certain members of the population for a long time. It's easy to mock certain superficial aspects of this identity politics. But let us recognize that, you know, people are protesting against structural inequality and violence that has been around for decades and decades.
But then it goes around and comes out the other end in, you know, white working class Americans, if you want to lump them into that kind of group, vociferously supporting Trump with their own identity politics because they feel left out and jumped over.
Well, also, let's not forget that who started the identity politics game? Who constructed racial hierarchies? Who relegated African Americans or Native Americans in the first place? That was the first exercise of identity politics and the most powerful and enduring exercise. What people today are doing is simply pushing back against those humiliating racial hierarchies that were put in place and that have remained, in many cases, unchanged all through the intervening decades.
In 15 seconds, do you have a favorite philosopher?
I do. His name happens to be the Buddha.
And we will leave it there and let you all project what he may be thinking about the Buddha onto that answer as we run out of time with Pankaj Mishra, who is the author now of Age of Anger, A History of the Present. And if you want to see him in person, he'll be at the Brooklyn Public Library with Hari Kundru, 7:30 tomorrow night. Thank you so much for joining us. Very thought-provoking.
Thank you, Brian.